Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Sections 6 and 7. Section 6. Probability. Even if there were no such thing as chance in the world, our ignorance of the real cause of any event has the same effect on the understanding, and generates the same kinds of belief or opinion as knowledge about chances does. It can certainly happen that an outcome is probable, because the chances of its occurring are greater than the chances of its not occurring, and the probability is greater, and the corresponding belief stronger, in proportion to how much the former chances exceed the latter. If a die were marked with 2 spots on 4 of its sides, and with 3 spots on the 2 remaining sides, then it would be more probable that when the die was thrown, it would turn up 2, than that it would turn up 3. If it had 1,000 sides, with 999 of them marked with 2 spots, and the remaining one side marked with 3 spots, the probability of its turning up 2 would be much higher, and our belief or expectation of that outcome would be more steady and secure. This process of thought or reasoning may seem trivial and obvious, but it offers plenty to think about for those who attend to it carefully. It seems clear that when the mind looks to the future to learn which outcome will result from the throw of such a die, it considers the turning up of each particular side as equally probable. And this is the very nature of chance, to render all the particular outcomes that it covers entirely equal. But the mind, finding that a greater number of sides involve one outcome, turning up 2, than in the other, turning up 3, is carried more frequently to the former outcome, meeting it oftener in revolving the various possibilities or chances on which the final outcome depends. This situation, in which several views involve one particular outcome, immediately generates the sentiment of belief, giving that outcome the advantage over its antagonist, which is supported by fewer views and crops up less frequently in the mind. We cannot fully explain this generation of belief, but perhaps it may become somewhat accounted for if we allow that belief is nothing but a firmer and stronger conception of an object than what accompanies the mere fictions of the imagination. The combination of these several views or glimpses imprints the idea more strongly on the imagination, gives it greater force and vigour, renders its influence on the passions and affections more obvious, and, in short, creates that reliance or security that constitutes the nature of belief and opinion. With the probability of causes, the situation is the same as it is with the probability of chance. Some causes are entirely uniform and constant in producing a particular kind of effect, with no known instance of any failure or irregularity in their operation. Fire has always burned, and water has always suffocated, every human creature. The production of motion by impact and gravity is a universal law, which up to now has had no exceptions. But other causes have been found to be more irregular and uncertain. Rhubarb hasn't always worked as a purge, or opium as a soporific. It is true that when any cause fails to produce its usual effect, scientists don't ascribe this to any irregularity in nature, but rather suppose that some secret causes in the particular structure of parts have prevented the operation. Our reasonings about the outcome are the same, however, as if this principle concerning secret causes didn't apply. Custom has made us transfer the past to the future in all our inferences. So where the past has been entirely regular and uniform, we expect the usual outcome with the greatest confidence, and leave no room for any contrary supposition. But where different effects have been found to follow, from causes that appear exactly alike, all these various effects must occur to the mind when it moves from the past to the future, and must enter into our thoughts when we estimate the probability of an outcome. Though we opt for the one that has been found to be the most usual, believing that it will occur this time too, we have to take into account the other effects, assigning to each a particular weight and authority in proportion to how frequently we have encountered it. In almost every country of Europe, it is more probable that there will be frost sometime in January than that January will be frost-free throughout. Though this probability varies according to the different climates, and it approaches certainty in the more northern kingdoms. Here then it seems evident that when we transfer the past to the future in order to predict the effect that will result from any cause, we transfer all the different outcomes in the same proportion as they have appeared in the past, and conceive, for instance, one to have existed 100 times, another 10 times, and another once. As a great number of views here point to one outcome, they fortify and confirm it to the imagination, generate the sentiment that we call belief, and make us prefer that outcome to the contrary one that is supported by fewer experiences and shows up less often in our thought in transferring the past to the future. Section 7. The Idea of Necessary Connection. The mathematical sciences have a great advantage over the sciences that deal with human nature, namely, that the ideas of the former, being based on the senses, are always clear and determinate. The smallest distinction between them is immediately perceptible, and the same terms continue to stand for the same ideas without ambiguity or variation. An oval is never mistaken for a circle, nor a hyperbola for an ellipse. The isosceles and scalene triangles are distinguished by boundaries more exact than those between vice and virtue, right and wrong. When a term is defined in geometry, the mind always promptly substitutes the definition for the term defined. And even when no definition is employed, the object itself may be presented to the senses, and thereby be clearly and firmly grasped. But the more subtle sentiments of the mind, the operations of the understanding, the various agitations of the passions, though really in themselves distinct from one another, easily escape us when we reflectively look in on them, and we are not able to recall the original object every time we have occasion to think about it. Ambiguity, by this means, is gradually introduced into our reasonings. Similar objects are readily taken to be the same, and eventually the conclusion goes far beyond the premises. Still, it's safe to say that if we consider these sciences in a proper light, we'll see that their respective advantages and disadvantages make them nearly equal. Although the mind more easily retains clear and determinate ideas in geometry, it must carry on a much longer and more intricate chain of reasoning, and compare ideas that are more disparate, in order to reach the more abstruse truths of that science. On the other side, although ideas relating to human nature are likely to fall into obscurity and confusion if we aren't extremely careful, the inferences are always much shorter in these inquiries, with far fewer steps from premises to conclusion than in the sciences that deal with quantity and number. The proof of almost every proposition in Euclid's geometry has more parts than are to be found in any fully coherent reasoning about human nature. When we trace the principles of the human mind through a few steps, we can be well satisfied with our progress, considering how soon nature puts up barriers to all our inquiries into causes and reduces us to admitting our ignorance. Thus, the chief obstacle to our advancement in the human or metaphysical sciences is the obscurity of the ideas and the ambiguity of the terms. The principal difficulty in mathematics is the length of inferences and scope of thought needed for reaching any conclusion. And it may be that what chiefly holds back our progress in natural science is the lack of relevant experiences and phenomena, which are often found only by chance, and sometimes, when needed, can't be found at all, even by the most persistent and careful inquiry. As the study of human nature seems until now to have advanced less than either geometry or physics, we may conclude that if there is any difference in this respect among these sciences, the difficulties that obstruct the progress of the human sciences require the greater care and skill to be surmounted. Of all the ideas that occur in metaphysics, none are more obscure and uncertain than those of power, force, energy, or necessary connection, which we must employ at every moment in our inquiries. So I'll try in this section to fix, as far as possible, the precise meaning of these terms, thereby removing some of the obscurity that is so much complained of in this kind of philosophy. It seems that there won't be much dispute about this proposition. All our ideas are merely copies of our impressions, so it is impossible for us to think of anything that we haven't previously felt through either our external or our internal senses. I tried in Section 2 to explain and prove this proposition, expressing my hope that men may, by applying it properly, make their philosophical reasonings clearer and more precise than ever before. Perhaps complex ideas can be well known by definition, for a definition merely enumerates the parts or simple ideas that make up the defined idea. But when we have pushed definitions back to the simplest ideas, and still find some ambiguity and obscurity, where can we turn for help? What technique can we use to throw light on these ideas, and give our minds an altogether precise and determinate grasp of them? The answer is that we can produce the impressions or original sentiments from which the ideas are copied. These impressions are all strong and sensible. There can be no ambiguity in them. They are not only brilliantly lit themselves, but may throw light on the corresponding ideas that lie in the dark. Perhaps, by this means, we can come to have a new microscope, so to speak, through which in the human sciences the smallest and simplest ideas can be enlarged enough to be readily grasped, and to be as well known as the biggest and most sensible ones. To be fully acquainted with the idea of power, or necessary connection, therefore, let us examine the impression that it copies. And in order to find that impression with greater certainty, let us search for it in all the sources from which the idea might have been derived. When we look around us at external objects, and think about the operation of causes, we never find in any individual case any power or necessary connection, anything that ties the effect to the cause, so that it has to follow the cause. All we find is that the one event does in fact follow the other. The impact of one billiard ball is accompanied by motion in the other. This is all that appears to the outer senses. The mind feels no sentiment or inward impression from this sequence of events. So no individual instance of cause and effect contains anything that can suggest the idea of power or necessary connection. Whenever we experience something for the first time, we cannot conjecture what effect will result from it. But if the power or energy of any cause were discoverable by the mind, we would be able to foresee the effect, even if we had no previous experience of similar items, and would be able, straight off, to say with confidence what the effect would be simply through thought and reasoning. In fact, no material thing ever reveals through its sensible qualities any power or energy, or gives us a basis for thinking that it will produce anything, or be followed by any other item that we could call its effect. Solidity, extension, motion. These qualities are all complete in themselves, and never point to any other item that might result from them. The scenes of the universe are continually shifting, and one object follows another in an uninterrupted sequence. But the power or force that drives the whole machine is entirely concealed from us, and never shows itself in any of the sensible qualities of material things. We know that, in fact, heat constantly accompanies flame, but we have no basis on which to conjecture or imagine, let alone to know, what the connection is between flame and heat. So the idea of power can't be derived from our experience of bodies in single instances of their operation, because no bodies ever reveal any power that could be the origin of this idea. Since external objects, as they appear to our senses, give us no idea of power or necessary connection by their operation in particular instances, let us see whether this idea is derived from our reflection on the operations of our own minds, and thus copied from some internal impression. Here is something that may be said. We are conscious of internal power all the time, while we feel that by the simple command of our will we can move our limbs or change our thoughts. An act of volition produces motion in our limbs or raises a new idea in our imagination. We know this influence of our will by being conscious of it. That is how we acquire the idea of power or energy, and it is what makes us certain that we ourselves and all other intelligent beings are possessed of power. So this idea is an idea of reflection, since it arises from reflecting on the operations of our own minds, and on the will's command over the organs of the body and faculties of the soul. I shall examine this claim, first with regard to the influence of volition over the organs of the body. This influence, like all other natural events, can be known only by experience. We never find in a cause any energy or power that connects it with the effect and makes the effect absolutely certain to follow. The motion of our body follows the command of our will. We are conscious of this at every moment. But how this comes about, the energy through which the will performs such an extraordinary operation, is something we are not immediately conscious of. Indeed, we cannot find it, however hard we look. I now give three reasons for believing this. First, the most mysterious principle in nature is that of the union of mind and body, in which a supposed spiritual substance gets so much influence over a material substance that the most refined thought can drive large portions of matter, such as human limbs. If we had the power to move mountains or control the planets just by secretly wishing these results to occur, this wide-ranging power wouldn't be more extraordinary or further from our understanding than the power our thoughts do have over our bodies. But if we perceived any power or energy in our own will, just by being conscious of it, we would know this power, know its connection with the effect, know the secret union of soul and body, and know the natures of these substances that enable one to operate so often on the other. Secondly, we know from experience that we don't have an equal command over all the organs of our body, though we can't explain why there is this remarkable difference between one and the other. Why can the will influence the tongue and fingers, not the heart or liver? This question wouldn't perplex us if we were conscious of a power in the former case and not in the latter. We would then perceive, independently of experience, why the will's authority over the organs of the body is kept within certain limits. Being fully acquainted with the power or force by which the will operates, we would also know why its influence reaches precisely as far as it does, and no further. It often happens that someone who has been suddenly struck with paralysis in a leg or arm, or who has recently lost a limb, tries to get the paralyzed or lost limb to perform its usual tasks. In this case, he is as much conscious of power to command such limbs as a man in perfect health is conscious of power to move his limbs, but consciousness never deceives. Consequently, we are never conscious of any power in either case, i.e., with a limb lost or paralyzed, or with all limbs present and correct. We learn the influence of our will from experience alone, and experience teaches us only how one event constantly follows another, without instructing us in the secret connection that binds them inseparably together. Thirdly, we learn from anatomy that when we make a voluntary movement, the immediate object of power is not the body part that is moved, but certain muscles and nerves and animal spirits, and perhaps something still tinier and more unknown, through which the motion is passed along to the body part we are trying to move. Can there be a more certain proof that the power by which this whole operation is performed, far from being directly and fully known by an inward feeling or consciousness, is utterly mysterious and impossible to understand? The mind wills a certain event. Immediately another event is produced, one that we don't know, and that is totally different from the one intended. This event produces another, which is equally unknown, and finally, through a long sequence of such intermediaries, the desired event is produced. How can we be conscious of a power to move our limbs when we have no such power? all we have is a power to move certain animal spirits which, though they eventually make our limbs move, operate in a manner that is wholly beyond our understanding. From all of this, we can safely conclude that our idea of power is not copied from any feeling or consciousness of power within ourselves, when we get our limbs to perform their normal functions. That their motion follows the command of the will is something we find from common experience, like other natural events, but the power or energy by which this is brought about, like that in other natural events, is unknown and inconceivable. Well then, shall we assert that we are conscious of a power or energy in our own minds when, by an act or command of our will, we make something happen in our minds? For example, when we raise up a new idea, make our mind focus on it, turn it on all sides, and finally dismiss it when we think that we have inspected it in enough careful detail? I believe the same arguments will show that even this command of the will gives us no real idea of force or energy. Firstly, it must be allowed that when we know a power, we know what it is about the cause that enables it to produce the effect, for these are supposed to be synonymous. To know the power, therefore, we must know both the cause and effect, and the relation between them. But do we claim to be acquainted with the nature of the human mind, and the nature of an idea, or the aptitude of the mind to produce the idea? Producing an idea is a real creation, a production of something out of nothing, and that implies a power so great that it may seem at first sight to be beyond the reach of any finite being. At least it must be admitted that such a power isn't felt or known by the mind, and isn't even conceivable by it. We only feel the event, namely the existence of an idea following a command of the will. How this operation is performed, the power by which it is produced, is entirely beyond our understanding. Secondly, the mind's command over itself, like its command over the body, is limited. And these limits are not known by reason, or by any acquaintance with the nature of cause and effect, but only, as we know all other natural events, by experience and observation. Our authority over our feelings and passions is much weaker than our authority over our ideas, and even the latter authority is contained within narrow boundaries. Will anyone claim to assign the ultimate reason for these boundaries, or show why the power is lacking in one case and not in another? Thirdly, this self-command is very different at different times. A healthy man has more of it than a sick one. We are more master of our thoughts in the morning than in the evening, and more when fasting than after a full meal. Can we give any reason for these variations except experience? Where, then, is the power we claim to be conscious of? Isn't there here, in either a spiritual or material substance or both, some secret mechanism or structure of parts on which the effect depends? And since this is entirely unknown to us, isn't the power or energy of the will equally unknown and incomprehensible? Surely we are well enough acquainted with volition, considered as an act of the mind. Reflect on it. Consider it on all sides. Do you find anything in it like this creative power, through which it creates a new idea out of nothing, and with a kind of "let it be so," imitates the omnipotence of God, if I may be allowed so to speak, who called into existence all the various scenes of nature by saying things like "let there be light"? Far from being conscious of this energy in the will, we need solid experiential evidence, if we are to be convinced that such extraordinary effects ever do result from a simple act of volition. People in general find it easy to explain the more common and familiar operations of nature, such as the falling of heavy bodies, the growth of plants, the procreation of animals, and the nourishment of bodies by food. They think that in all these cases they perceive the force or energy of the cause, which guarantees that the effect will follow. Through long habit, they come to be in a frame of mind such that, when the cause appears, they immediately and confidently expect its usual outcome, and think it virtually inconceivable that any other outcome could result from that cause. It's only when they encounter extraordinary phenomena, such as earthquakes, plagues, and strange events of any kind, that they struggle to assign a proper cause, and to explain how the effect has been produced. In such difficulties, men usually fall back on some invisible thinking cause, as the immediate cause of the surprising event, that they think cannot be explained through the common powers of nature. But philosophers, who look a little deeper, immediately perceive that the energy of the cause is no more intelligible in the most familiar events than it is in the most unusual ones, and that we only learn by experience the frequent conjunction of things without ever finding any connection between them. Here, then, many philosophers, most notably Malebranche, think that reason obliges them to appeal in ordinary cases to the same cause that common people appeal to, only in cases that appear miraculous and supernatural. These philosophers hold that an intelligent mind is the immediate and sole cause of every event that appears in nature, not merely the ultimate and original cause of all events, or the immediate and sole cause of seemingly miraculous events. They claim that the items that are commonly called causes are really nothing but occasions, and that the true and direct cause of every effect is not any power or force in nature, but a volition of the Supreme Being, who wills that such and such particular pairs of items should forever be conjoined. Instead of saying that one billiard ball moves another by a force that the author of nature bestowed on it, they say that it is God himself who moves the second ball, by a particular act of will, having been led to do this by the impact of the first ball, in conformity with the general laws that he has laid down for himself in the government of the universe. But philosophers push their inquiries further, and discover that, just as we are totally ignorant of the power through which bodies act on one another, so we are equally ignorant of the power through which mind acts on body, or body acts on mind, and that neither our senses nor our consciousness tells us what the ultimate cause is in any of these interactions. So they are led by the same ignorance to the same conclusion. They assert that God is the immediate cause of the union of mind with body, and that sensations in the mind are not produced by sense organs that have been activated by external objects, but rather it is a particular volition of God's that arouses a particular kind of sensation in consequence of a particular motion in the sense organ. Similarly, the movements of our limbs aren't produced by any energy in our will. Rather, they say, it is God himself who chooses to back up our will, which in itself has no power to do anything, and to command the bodily motion which we wrongly attribute to our own power and efficacy. Thus, according to these philosophers, everything is full of God. Not content with the principle that nothing exists except by his will, that nothing has any power except with his permission, they rob nature and all created beings of every power, so as to make their dependence on God still more obvious and immediate. They overlook the fact that by this theory they diminish, instead of magnifying, the grandeur of the divine attributes that they purport to celebrate so much. God's delegating some power to lesser creatures surely shows him as more powerful than would his producing everything by his own immediate volition. It indicates more wisdom to structure the world from the outset with such perfect foresight that it will serve God's purposes by its own way of operating, when left to itself, than if God needed at every moment to adjust the world's parts and animate, by his breath, all the wheels of that stupendous machine. But if you want a more philosophical rather than theological case against this theory, perhaps the two following reflections may suffice. First, it seems to me that this theory of the universal energy and operation of the Supreme Being is too bold ever to convince someone who knows how weak and limited human reason is. Even if the chain of arguments leading to the theory were ever so logical, there would have to be a strong suspicion, if not absolute certainty, that it has carried us quite beyond the reach of our faculties when it leads to conclusions that are so extraordinary and so remote from common life and experience. Long before we have reached the last steps of the argument leading to our theory, we are already in fairyland. and there we have no reason to trust our common methods of argument, or to think that our usual analogies and probabilities carry any weight. Our line is too short to fathom such immense depths. Second, I can't see any force in the arguments this theory is based on. It's true that we are ignorant of how bodies act on one another. Their force or energy is entirely incomprehensible. But aren't we equally ignorant of the manner or force by which a mind, even the supreme mind, acts either on itself or on body? I ask you, from where do we acquire any idea of that force? We have no feeling or consciousness of this power in ourselves. We have no idea of the supreme being, except what we get from looking into our own faculties. So if our ignorance were a good reason for denying anything, it would justify denying all energy in the supreme being, as much as denying it in the crudest matter. We surely understand the operations of the former as little as we do those of the latter. Is it harder to conceive that motion may arise from impact than to conceive that it may arise from volition? All we know is our profound ignorance in both cases. Part 2. There is one possible source for the idea of connection or power that I haven't yet examined. When we are confronted by any natural object or event of which we have had no experience, no amount of cleverness and hard work will enable us to discover or even guess what event will result from it, or to make any prediction that goes beyond what is immediately present to our memory and senses. Even after we know from experience what the result was in a particular case, we aren't entitled to bring it under a general rule, or to predict what will happen in similar cases in the future. Basing a view about the whole course of nature on a single experience, however carefully detailed or certain it may be, is rightly thought to be too bold. But if events of one kind have always, in all instances, been associated with events of some other kind, we confidently predict an event of the latter kind when we experience one of the former kind. We then call one the cause, and the other the effect. We suppose there to be some connection between them, some power in the cause by which it infallibly produces the effect, operating with the greatest certainty and strongest necessity. The source of this idea of a necessary connection among events seems to be a number of similar instances of the regular pairing of events of these two kinds, and the idea cannot be prompted by any one of these instances on its own, however comprehensively we examine it. But what can a number of instances contain that is different from any single instance that is exactly like them? Only that when the mind experiences many similar instances, it acquires a habit of expectation. The repetition of the pattern affects it in such a way that when it observes an event of one of the two kinds, it expects an event of the other kind to follow. So the feeling or impression from which we derive our idea of power or necessary connection is a feeling of connection in the mind, a feeling that accompanies the imagination's habitual move from observing one event to expecting another of the kind that usually follows it. That's all there is to it. Study the topic from all angles. You will never find any other origin for that idea. This is the only difference between a single instance, which can never give us the idea of connection, and a number of similar instances, which do suggest the idea. The first time a man saw motion being passed from one thing to another in a collision, as when one billiard ball hits another, he couldn't say that the red ball's starting to move was connected with the white ball's hitting it, but only that one event followed the other. After seeing several instances of this kind, he then says that they, i.e., the two events within each instance, are connected. What has happened to give rise to this new idea of connection? Only that he now feels these events to be connected in his imagination, and can predict the occurrence of one from the appearance of the other. So when we say that one event is connected with another, all we mean is that they have come to be connected in our thought, so that we're willing to conduct this inference through which they are taken to be proofs of each other's existence. This is a strange conclusion. but it seems to be well supported by the evidence. Even people who are in a general way cautious about what the understanding can achieve, or sceptical about every conclusion that is new and extraordinary, shouldn't on that account be suspicious of this conclusion. It announces a discovery about the weakness and narrow limits of human reason and capacity. Nothing could be more agreeable to scepticism than it is. End of section 7.